This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
When Brian Koberger abruptly took a plea deal admitting guilt in to the chilling murders that stole four promising lives, it was the legal equivalent of slamming on the brakes of a roller coaster seconds before the stomach-dropping plunge. We'd spent nearly 3 years inching to the apex, readying ourselves for the jamming twists and turns of that trial. And then, silence. No trial, no jury, no dramatic cross-examinations, just Koberger awkwardly standing up in court, confirming coldly that he was indeed the monster we'd feared him to be all along. But was it as simple as it seemed? Today, to unpack the psychological complexity of why Koberger stepped off the ride at the last second, I'm joined by former FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Drake. If anyone can unravel the web of calculated, detached, and frankly chilling motives lurking behind this plea, it's Robin. Throughout this conversation, Robin and I confront some deeply uncomfortable truths. Did Koberger really surrender because he feared the death penalty? Or was there something deeper, something darker at play? Maybe the public spectacle of the entire thing, his entire life being dissected piece by humiliating piece, was too daunting even for someone as twisted as he is. Maybe, just maybe, he saw this as his chance to perform the only remotely humane gesture he's capable of, sparing his family from endless appeals and emotional trauma. But does someone like Koberger even think like that? That's the question. Robin dives into the unsettling paradox at the core of this case. He explains how the very justice system designed to punish a criminal like Koberger might inadvertently offer him exactly what he desires: infamy, notoriety, and endless attention from psychologists, criminologists, and the public. We explore the harrowing possibility that Koberger's cold calculation extends beyond his crimes into his punishment. Did he strategically choose prison over death, not because of remorse, but because it aligned with his twisted sense of achievement and notoriety? And let's be honest, what about his defense attorney, Ann Taylor? Robin and I tackle that. It must feel like what it must feel like to represent someone who admits, without remorse or emotion, to such horrific acts. How can an attorney maintain professional detachment with a client beside them that admits openly to slaughtering four innocent people? I'm not criticizing Ann Taylor, but we're going to talk about it. First, Robin, let's dive straight into the question everyone's wondering about, given the magnitude of evidence against him and the potential humiliation awaiting him at trial. Why did Brian Koberger decide to stop his deadly ride at the very top of the roller coaster? In the bigger 10,000-foot picture, and having someone who doesn't have a child invested in this, whose life was taken, I don't know that I would have trusted a jury on this either. Granted, yeah. There's a lot of damning evidence here. A lot of it is circumstantial, but all you need, as we've seen in several cases in this last year, all you need is one. And it's not that you have one that's like out there being the Dexter and they're fighting, you know, as a vigilante. They're just dumb. They're just misinformed. They're a low IQ. They have some sort of personal trauma or vendetta that they're going to project onto this case rather than actually look at the evidence. And they're going to say screw you to the system for their own personal stuff rather than the actual case that's going on. And that would have not been that crazy of a possibility here. So there was a very real possibility that Koberger could have walked. And the fact that that now is completely out of the question, I think, is a good thing.
I am 100% with that. And boy, I tell you, the dichotomy of joy and cringe on this was palpable with me as well, because I hear the families. I'm like, absolutely, he needs to go before the death penalty because they want the death penalty, and really they should be the deciding factor. At the same time, I'm on the side also of there's no appeals, there's no jury. And Tony, here's one bit I alluded to at the very beginning I think is really, really psychologically powerful. At least it would be for me, and it would be on all these other cases that you and I have covered. In every other case, especially if there's a murder case, and someone is being charged with murder and it goes through a jury and they're claiming their innocence, even if the jury finds them guilty, there's a shred of doubt. You know, I mean, because the defense attorney's job is to sow doubt. Mm-hmm. And with a little bit of that doubt wheedle in, if they're claiming they're innocent, and even if they're convicted, was there someone else involved? Wasn't there? But when you have a confession, mm-hmm. I did it, there is no doubt.
Yeah.
It was him. I can have closure. There is no one else out there. There was no other conspiracy out there. It is him. Mm-hmm. The sentence is what is the... So I guess that's a better way to put it.
Yeah.
I don't... You know, it's not the fact that he confessed. It's the fact that it's the sentence, which is not negotiable.
Yeah. Are you surprised at all that... this is... He's writing the ticket. There's no coming back from this. You are... Yep. He's down and out. There is behind bars and that's it. There's no possibility of parole. There's no appeals. There's nothing he can do. He will die in prison. Are you at all surprised that he was completely ready for this and just seems almost eager for this next chapter in his journey to start? For someone who we have analyzed to kind of play the devil's advocate on this, why not go through the trial? Why not take that part of the ride? Why did he step off the ride right when we were getting to the very top of the roller coaster, about to go down? We've been climbing this for 3 years. Why now? Why suddenly now go, eh? Is it the fear of death? Or was it more of a fear of embarrassment? and being called out on every single dumb thing that you've done in this case. And then let's dissect your childhood. Let's dissect your life, because that was going to come into play too. And then take another look at all of the dumb choices that you've made and all the failures that you have. It really makes me wonder, was it more so being humiliated publicly in front of the nation in a courtroom setting that he was more fearful of, or was it death?
I don't think that played into it for him. If I'm guessing, I think he was fine with either. I think he was going to enjoy the trial because he's going to get to relive what he did. Because again, this is the fantasy aspect of why serial killers do what they do. I think that it probably had a large part to do with his attorney who wanted to save his life and his parents. I think, you know, as a mom and dad, they're probably, you know, I'd imagine pleading with him, just take the deal, just take the deal, just take the deal, because at least we can still talk to you. At least we can still have contact with you. At least you can save us the money of all these appeals that we're going to have to go through. See what I mean? I think it's because he, for all that he has an ability to, he did have a relationship with his parents. His parents never abandoned him. His parents were always there for him. His parents were there during the worst times for him, especially his dad. I think, again, it's so hard to put myself in those shoes, that deep act of empathy that we talk about, but I think he probably did as much for them. If he's, I mean, it's probably the only selfless act he might have done is this one, is where he agreed to take the plea deal for his parents.
Makes you wonder, because it is the only, and granted, we have not had a great view of Koberger, meaning we haven't heard him speak much. I mean, this is like really the first time he's spoken. He stood silent, literally, at the initial plea hearing. This is the first time we've heard him say yes and no, but we don't have a lot of context to his personality other than those writings of his youth. And in those writings where he's talking about the visual snow, he does seem to recognize, and this seems more like from a learned behavior than it is a cognitive, I empathetically feel bad that I'm hurting my dad, but he did seem to recognize that he is hurtful to his father, and he doesn't know why he is, and doesn't seem to know how to control it or why he's doing it. So I wonder if that was part of it, of a, well, they're asking me to do this. They have done things for me. Maybe this is a fair exchange. You know, just a very mechanical way of looking at it. Not like a, let me not put them through this. They've been through enough already. Just a, well, they filled this jug for me. I'll fill that jug for them, because that seems to be the transactional way of doing things. It does make you wonder.
I think, I mean, the fact, again, I keep going back to the data points of the dad going driving cross country to pick up his son to drive him all the way back, you know, right before they caught him. That's a relationship. You know, he didn't do it out of anger. He did it out of love. That father did it out of love.
No, completely.
And so whether Brian can reciprocate that emotion or not, he recognizes the emotion. That's why he wanted to be able to feel things, because he's seen other people have these things. Mm-hmm. And so whether he actually felt compassion towards his parents' request, if that, again, conjecture if it was a request or not, or they pressured him, he knew it would be good for them to take this. So I think that's why one of the reasons why it probably weighed in on him. And also Ann Taylor, she stood by with him. Oh my God. You know, and she, you know, I would imagine he can recognize healthy behaviors. He just can't have them.
Yeah.
Because of that lack of capacity. So when he recognizes people doing well on his behalf, like his professor, like his attorney, like his parents, he wants to reciprocate. And so that's why he comes across as mechanical, because he knows the actions he should take. I mean, we see this with psychopaths all the time. Yeah. They know the actions they should take. That's why they come across as creepy, because they don't feel emotionally the output they're giving you non-verbally and verbally. And so that incongruence makes them come across as creepy, like you've seen in the courtroom, because he should have an emotional reaction to the environment around him, but he's not. And so, because I would imagine he's recognizing what people are doing and showing compassion in his immediate family, and he's wanting to have the behaviors to reciprocate that. Well, I'm jumping way out on limbs here on conjecture. Giving him a lot of credit.
That's what we did.
But maybe I shouldn't. But again, we're trying to figure out why he did these things. I'm thinking that's the most plausibility for me.
Yeah. No, I hear you. The control aspect of this. I want to say this before I go to control. Ann Taylor, I wonder how long she's known that he did this. I mean, not just like in her heart of just like, yeah, he definitely did this, but I'm representing him. I have to do my job. Versus when he's actually admitting to it and saying it, that's gotta be, I don't know. I mean, you gotta have a certain personality to do that job, but that had to have been a weird moment when you go home at night and it's like, this guy that you've been fighting for all this time is calculated as it was. He's just flat out coldly said, I did all of it. I killed every single one of them.
I'd be bathing in the courtroom.
What's that?
And they're sitting next to him in court. I literally saw that. So here's this cold-blooded killer that killed four teens and they're sitting and his two female attorneys and co-attorneys are sitting right next to him in that courtroom.
I'd be bathing in
bleach.
Does
that not creep you out?
I mean, at night, that's a bathtub full of Purell. The creepy level of that. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, again, it's people want to criticize defense attorneys, and I get it. But it is a good thing that they exist. We do need people to represent those that are not being represented, and not everybody is guilty. But this is truly, obviously, a case where he is. Listening to Robin Dreek break down the chillingly detached mindset of Brian Koberger feels like staring straight into an emotional black hole. Nothing escapes. Nothing resonates. It's tempting to hope that Koberger's last-minute plea deal signals some microscopic flicker of humanity, some buried instinct to spare his family further pain, or even an impulse to acknowledge his own monstrous actions. As Robin points out, even those small gestures of humanity might be more mechanical than emotional. It's the disturbing possibility that even Koberger's so-called acts of kindness, accepting a plea, sparing his parents years of appeals, are rooted less in compassion and more in calculated transactional thinking. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. Robin offered a profoundly unsettling notion. Koberger may have chosen to avoid trial, not because he feared death or even embarrassment, but because the structured isolation of prison aligns precisely with his comfort zone. It's a devastating paradox that the punishment society hopes will break him might actually feel like coming home. Think about that. Replacing a sociopath in an environment designed to be punitive, yet it might feel like his natural habitat. That's justice flipped on its head. Punishment becoming reward. It's also the haunting image Robin evoked. Ann Taylor and her defense team sitting inches away from Koberger in court as he openly admitted to this horrific crime. Imagine fighting relentlessly to defend someone, only to have them coldly confirm everything you've spent years trying to disprove. And you have to sit there with a smile on your face. I'm not criticizing Ann Taylor. She did her job, and she's damn good at being a defense attorney. The emotional toll that has to be immense. Bathing in Purell level immense. As I so vividly described. Yet it's a stark reminder of the essential and complicated role defense attorneys play, even in cases as gruesome as this one. We might find their position distasteful, but they're the ones who ensure the justice system remains fair and balanced, even when facing undeniable evil. Still, as we step away from this grim courtroom spectacle, we're left with an unnerving question. Did Koberger's abrupt plea rob the families of true justice, or did it spare them the trauma of a painful trial? It's a cruel irony that in sparing himself humiliation, Koberger may have unintentionally spared the families months of courtroom torment, even if he denied them the final say to the death penalty. The deeper truth Robin illuminated is unsettling. The justice system, while necessary and crucial, isn't designed for someone who sees punishment as reward. Koberger's satisfaction in his punishment forces us to question how we deliver justice to those who don't just expect punishment. They crave it. That's a haunting thought to sit with as this chapter closes. Robin Dreek has always helped us navigate the unsettling maze of this case, but we are still left to grapple with how justice feels incomplete when the criminal embraces punishment was victory. Be sure to let me know what your thoughts are in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not there already on our YouTube channel, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi so you can join us there. If you're listening to us on the podcast platform going, where do I comment? It's YouTube. Go check it out over there. But be sure to hit subscribe wherever it is you're listening to us. If it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, whatever it is, please do hit subscribe. We do greatly, greatly appreciate your support of our program by hitting that subscribe button. Until next time, for all of us at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, and with Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your favorites and still hit your health goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at hero.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information. Thank you.